right, so afternoon. This will be our fourth week looking at Job. We have covered a whole lot of territory. It's probably worth kind of going back and reminding us where we're at. As you no doubt recall, if you've been with us on the previous ones, Job is a lengthy book, and it is really focusing on one long conversation. You learn in the first couple chapters some detail that kind of set up the conversation. At the end, you learn some details about what happens after the conversation, but the bulk of it is a conversation, and it's a conversation between one man and his four friends. And each of the friends are going to take a turn kind of arguing or debating about what is going on. And specifically, they're concerned with their buddy Job, who'd been, just a very prominent figure in society, well-known, well-loved, very wealthy, pretty much had everything going for him, who is now fallen into just a terrible, terrible state of affliction. He's lost his children. 10 of them that were all killed. He's lost all of his wealth. He had, numerous flocks and herds and things of, were just very tangible assets that were all taken from him all on the same day. And then he's also lost his health. He's covered nasty boils and sores. He has been emaciated. His bones are all sticking out. He's just skinny and drawn in and gaunt. People are mistreating him in the society where he lives. People who used to be afraid to even speak in his presence are now, actively tormenting him or terrorizing him or harming him. I mean, just pretty much anything that can go wrong has gone wrong. And the conversation, Job and his friends are talking about this, and they don't have the benefit of knowing what went on in chapters 1 and 2, where we get to see, from really God's perspective, what happened with the conversation between God and Satan, and Satan, accusing Job of saying, Job, who is this righteous man, he's only serving you, God, because you've blessed him so much. And if you take away those blessings, then he'll just curse you to his face. And so God, allows Satan to take away those blessings. And, Job doesn't curse God to his face. And then Satan appears again and says, well, he's still only serving you because he's still healthy. You take away his health, and then he'll curse you to his face. And so, again, God allows him, but he restricts him by saying you cannot kill him. So, fast-forwarding, these friends have come to comfort Job. They don't know all that's going on. And so the friends, they want to help. Their purpose for coming together has been to mourn and comfort him. And so they try to fix it. I don't know if y'all have ever been guilty of trying to fix it for yourself or for other people, but they think that the only reason that Job could be going through all this terrible suffering is if God is punishing him for some sin. Now, they don't know what he did, and so they're going to, through the course of this conversation, basically harp on the same argument over and over again that Job, only the wicked are going to be treated badly, therefore you must be wicked because you're treating badly. Therefore, you need to stop being wicked, and if you do, God will be nice to you. That's their basic theme, and they're going to kind of say that in different ways. And to which, each time as they're going around talking, because one friend will talk, and then Job will respond, and the second friend will talk, and Job will respond, and they'll follow this pattern going through. To where Job, his response, basically each of them is, yeah, but I didn't do it. I'm innocent. And he takes that position so firmly that he goes too far. God had described him in the beginning as a righteous man, a man of integrity who was upright and served God. Those are all great things. I would love for God to describe me that way. That's how he described Job. And so while Job is patiently enduring his suffering, he's gotten to a point now where he's really had enough, and he starts going too far, because he not only declares, I didn't do anything to merit all this, but the way I'm being treated isn't just. And the only person who's could do all this stuff is God. And therefore God is being unjust by treating me this way. If anyone's wrong in this matter, it's not me. I'm righteous. It has to be God. And so Job starts sinning by accusing God of injustice. Now, the three friends, as they're going around, each of them try to, you know, persuade Job of their position that, you know, Job, you really are a sinner. We don't know what you did, but you must have done it. And you need to repent from it. And Job isn't convinced. He's not convinced by any of their arguments. He finally says, you know, even if I have sinned, it's hidden. It's hidden from you. It's hidden from me. It's sealed up in a bag. We don't even know what it is. But regardless of this, when it all comes out in the wash, I know I'm going to come forth, you know, as pure as gold. And he's standing on his own merits and righteousness throughout the bulk of the conversation. So finally, the three friends, you know, basically give up. They don't know what else to say. They haven't convinced him of that he's been a sinner or that he's got a sin that's caused all this, but they have, you know, really condemned him. You know, they're assuming that they're right and that he's departed from serving God faithfully, and that's why he's being punished. Anyway, so their arguments, they don't make any headway with Job. Job continues to adamantly defend himself that he's innocent and the problem really lies with God. He's getting into some really dangerous territory. Last week, we looked at the kind of shift in the conversation. So that's really like phase one of the conversation. And there's these three rounds of the Job and the three friends going back and forth. These are who are commonly referred to as the miserable comforters, because they do a really terrible job of making Job feel better. Then there's a fourth friend who is there, who had been hidden. He wasn't introduced until he actually speaks up, and he's a younger man. He said he's going to let all the older men speak first, let wisdom, you know, teach him a thing or two, because surely the older folks have got wisdom. And then he gets angry. He's angry at Job for trying to justify himself rather than God. And he's angry at the three friends because they weren't able to give a good answer to respond to Job. And they, you know, wrongfully, you know, condemned him. His name is Elihu. And, you know, over the course of quite a few chapters, let's see, this is picking up in chapter 32 through 37 is all going to be Elihu speaking. And that's what we focused on last week. And Elihu, he's, of anyone speaking, he's really probably the most trustworthy. And as I, you know, mentioned in the disclaimer in the handout, that we have to be careful when we quote the book of Job for scriptural authority. Because you have speakers in here who are saying things that are not necessarily true. Job and his three friends are stating their understanding and their position, but they're not completely true. They're error mixed in. It's part of the reason why they're debating, trying to convince the other. And so we need to be very careful when we're looking at Job and we're trying to say, well, see, it says right here this, and I can use that to support whatever I think. Well, it may not necessarily be so. Of the men that are involved, Elihu is probably the most reliable figure to quote. And he's kind of standing in for God. And that's really the role that he's going to play. Because Job throughout this has been, you know, kind of shaking his fist saying, I just wish I could take God down to the local courthouse and, you know, sue him, have him give me some answers and get me a, you know, a verdict to declare why am I being treated so bad. He says, but, you know, I really can't do that because I'm scared of God, because he's so much greater than I am, and he's currently afflicting me, and I really don't want to argue with him while he's doing that. And so Elihu, you know, this fourth friend, you know, pops up and says, you know what, I'll stand in God's place. You're not going to be terrified of me, and I'm not, you know, actively involved in any of the afflictions that are going on, but I'm going to tell you how you're doing wrong by attempting to justify yourself rather than justifying God. Basically, the thrust of his argument is, if in doubt, we're wrong, not God. So y'all can go re-listen to last week's to get a more detailed account, but I just felt like it was necessary to kind of repackage just a little bit where all we've come from. So we've had the three friends arguing with Job, trying to convince him he's a sinner. Job adamantly defending himself, saying, no, I'm not, and if there's any problem, it's God's fault. And Elihu says, whoa, boy, God is so much higher than you. You can't talk to them like that. You've admitted that he's sovereign and that no one can stay his hand or ask him what you're doing, and yet that's exactly what you're doing. You're trying to ask God, you know, why are you treating me this way? And that, you know, you need to humbly, you know, accept what's going on and be patient to endure it. And if you don't know where you've erred, ask the Lord to teach it to you, rather than trying to argue with God and say, you know, God, you've been unjust. So that brings us all the way to kind of the final round, final part of the conversation. And this is when, kind of the most amazing portion of this text happens, is that God himself speaks. Now the word used in the King James Version is an all caps word, Lord. And whenever we see that in King James, we know that that is pulling from the manuscript in the Hebrew, which had the word Jehovah. All right. And I mention that because that's significant, because Abraham and Isaac, we're told, did not know the Lord by that name. They knew him as God, Elohim. But Jehovah wasn't revealed to the Israelites until God told Moses out of the burning bush what his name was. I am that I am. Jehovah means the eternal God, the God that is, that not is not past tense, he won't be future tense, he just always is. And so here, Jehovah is speaking out of a whirlwind. You can imagine a tornado or a really strong storm. And he's speaking to Job in an audible voice. And I must say, if you've ever been, upbraided by or chastised by a teacher in a classroom, that would probably be infinitely less terrifying than what Job is about to go through. I mean, he's about to be called out by the Almighty God of the universe. And, God begins by asking him a question. He says, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?" Basically, what he's saying is, he says, "Job, all your long speeches of defending yourself have done the exact opposite of what wise words should do, which would be to enlighten the listeners. And instead, you've kind of confused and muddied the issue, and you've made things seem less clear because you're talking about things you don't know." Okay. And then the Lord really commands Job to, put your big boy pants on. You need to gather yourself up like a valiant man, because I'm going to ask you some questions. Now, before, back in Job's time, he had been, pretending like he was talking to God and, wanted to ask him a series of questions, like he's the interrogator and God's the witness on the stand. Well, now God's asking the questions. He says, "Job, you need to stand up, because I'm going to ask you some questions." And he begins with a series of questions that start with God's creation, and the ordering and maintenance of the universe. So you've got not only the making of the universe, but also the maintaining, how it continues to go. And the purpose of these questions are to demonstrate how little knowledge men, including specifically Job, really possess, and how great are God's works. And so he starts by asking, "Where were you, Job, when I laid the foundation of the earth? How are those foundations secured?" I'm paraphrasing these, but this is the essence of it. "How are those foundations secured? Who laid the cornerstone?" Now, Jesus is one of his names is referred to as the cornerstone. And when you're building, that's the stone that everything else comes off of. What is to keep your line straight and flush or whatever? Who laid the cornerstone? Basically, who put down the first piece? Who limited the seas so it couldn't pass any further than the shores established by God? Have you, Job, caused the sun to rise each morning? And he continues these questions. Start from creation, and then they go into a progression through some of the cycles that God put in place, and that he continues to maintain: the cycles of days and nights, the cycles of water, and the water cycle, and not perspiration, precipitation. The movements of the stars and constellations in the skies, and then he, kind of goes from the heavenly and drills all the way down to the care and feeding of individual animals. And I'll note that in verse 30, 36, he reaffirms that God is the ultimate source of wisdom and understanding. So throughout this, God is really hammering the fact that, "Job, you weren't there. You don't know. You can't tell me any of these things," right? And then he continues on his examination through another series of questions, which focus on animals. He says, "Do you know when the wild goats or the wild deer are going to give birth to their young?" Men kind of get, lifted up and fried about, how well they know about their tame animals and when they're going to give birth, or, the knowledge they have. He says, "Well, what about the wild goats? You don't know about them, or the deer?" He asked, "Who set the wild donkeys loose to range in the wilderness? Who were able to survive, without men to take care of them? Who did that?" says, can you tame a unicorn? What's a unicorn? If I look up in Strong's, it's described as a wild bull. Can you take a wild bull from out in the wilderness and, you know, hitch him up to your plow and make him work for you? And the answer in all these is no. Did you give the peacock his beautiful feathers? What about the ostrich? Did you give her wings and feathers? And, you know, God here reveals that the ostrich is able to bury her eggs in the sand and then abandon them without being in distress, because God has withheld the knowledge of what she's doing from her. And then he goes and asks about horses. And who gave the horse strength? Can you, Job, make a horse afraid like a grasshopper's afraid? And then God gives a rather lengthy discussion about the qualities that he put into horses so that they are able to be ridden into battle without being afraid, and the strength that he's given them. And then he continues by asking, you know, did you give the hawks and the eagles the wisdom and the command to fly? Okay. And so we've got this, you know, you don't know anything about my creation in comparison. You don't really know anything about the animals that I've created. And then he goes on in chapter 40, says, you know, and all that really leads up to this question, you know, shall the man that is trying to argue with God also teach God something? You know, you're trying to argue with me. Can you teach me anything? And the answer is no, of course, that God already has all power, all knowledge, rather. And so he challenges him. He says, you know, that you who are trying to rebuke God, give an answer. Explain this stuff. All right? Now, Job at this point is humbled. And he doesn't try to give a long flowing answer or anything. He kind of puts his hand over his mouth. right before that, he says, you know, he knows now that he's vile. And, you know, the Strong's definition for vile just means a small, trifling thing. He understands that in comparison to God, he is really next to nothing. And he says he's just going to lay his hand upon his mouth and speak no more. But God's not finished with him. He continues with his interrogation. And he gives that demand, you know, Job, you need to gird yourself up. You need to stand up, put on your big boy pants and give me some answers to these questions. And he asks him, you know, will you disannul my judgment? Will you change my judgments? Will you make them so they don't exist? Will you condemn me that thou mayest be righteous? And this, if I had to pick one, I'd say this is the key verse. Key verse of the book, and highlights what Job's great error was. Because Job had been tempted to do just that. He wanted to overturn God's judgment to allow these afflictions to come on him. And in the process, he's been trying to condemn God, saying that he's been unjust, so Job could maintain that he had been righteous. All right. So having thoroughly through this process of, you know, questions that can't be answered, God's already demonstrated Job's, you know, lack of knowledge, really all man's lack of knowledge. So he shifts then to Job's lack of power. And what he's doing is he's highlighting the difference between men and God, Job and God. So you have no knowledge, basically. And then he shifts to power. And so he starts to challenge Job to demonstrate your power. Come on, Job, show me what you can do. Do you have an arm like God? You may say that's a weird expression, but the arm of God is used throughout the Bible, and it's used as an expression often in connection with how the Lord will demonstrate his power, his ability to perform his will. And so if you think about bringing the children of Israel out of Egypt, there are many expressions describing that process and all the plagues is God extending out his arm against Egypt. And there's another expression about the Lord's arm is not shortened, that it cannot save, of saying, you know, you ever had something that you just can't get to? It's gone under a car and your arm just not quite long enough to get it. And you're hurting yourself and straining trying to get it. Well, God's arm is never too short. There's nothing out of his reach that he can't accomplish. And that's in Isaiah 59:1. So it says, do you, Job, do you have an arm like God that can do whatever you desire? Anything to perform your will? The answer is obviously no. Do you have a voice that sounds like God? You know, God's voice is described as like many waters, and, just a terrifying thing. When God was talking to the children of Israel on Mount Sinai, they were afraid they were going to die. I mean, they were so scared. They really threw Moses under the bus and said, you know what? We don't want to hear from God directly anymore. You go talk to him and you just relay it to us because we're just scared to death. Right? Job, do you have a voice like that? So he said, no. And then God challenges Job to do some things that God can do. He says, put on majesty, excellency, beauty, and glory like their articles of clothing. Put them on yourself. Clearly they're hidden right now, Job, and you're not wearing them. Put them on. Majesty, excellency, beauty, and glory. And then while you've got those on, I want you to send out a demonstration of your rage. God can do that. And then I want you to cause all those that are proud to be humbled. Okay? So God can do all those things. Job obviously can't. The difference in their power. And then God says, only after you can do all those things would God then admit that Job, well, you're able to save yourself by your own right hand. So Job obviously can't. Job will never be able to do any of those things. And the point really just drives home the inferiority of man and how man is completely dependent upon God for all things, but especially for deliverance and salvation, that man cannot save himself by his own right hand. It's dependent upon God, right? All right, and then we get into some interesting verses where God directs Job's attention to two particular creatures. One is called Behemoth. So we're in chapter 40, verses 15 through 24. He points out the creature Behemoth. Now, if you look up the word Behemoth, all it says is that it is a plural form of a root word, which means dumb animal. So you got dumb beasts. He says, look at the dumb beasts. And he starts off by noting that this creature was made by God, just like men were made. But then he begins to list off the behemoth's qualities and strengths that are vastly superior to that of a man. And so what I think here is God is really further humbling Job, because he's already demonstrated that God has way more power than Job. He said, but not only that, you can't even compete with some of the dumb creatures that I've created. You're not even as strong as them. Who do you think you are arguing with me, trying to accuse me of being unjust? Idiot? I mean, he doesn't say that, but I mean, he's pointing out the vast disparity in power between God and even the dumb beast. And as far as power, you're below that. All right. And then in chapter 41, God uses another creature called the Leviathan. He asked Job, do you have enough power to capture that great creature called the Leviathan? If you look up the definition of Leviathan, it just says a wreath animal that is a serpent. So I don't know exactly what the Leviathan is. Some portions, it sounds like he's in the water. It sounds like a sea serpent. Other portions, it sounds like he's got some attributes that we would describe as like being a dragon, breathing fire. So we'll talk about that more in a minute. But the question is, Job, do you have enough power to, one, capture this big creature? No. Do you have the power to tame him or to cut him up and sell his pieces? Answer is apparently no. And it says, since no one is fierce enough to stand and fight against this Leviathan, a creature of God, then there really is no one who can stand and challenge God directly. God's letting Job know you are out of line by attempting to argue with God. And then God asks, who came before God such that God would owe that person anything or something? The answer is, of course, no one. And God declares, everything already belongs to him. There's no one who gave it to God. He's in charge. And then in verses 12 through 34 of chapter 41, God reveals some more information about the creature, the Leviathan, about his power and his strength. This is another example of a creature that God's made that has more power than a man. And again, as I said, there's some descriptions within this passages about breathing out smoke and fire, and it gives you the image of something that we would now describe as a dragon. And God knows the Leviathan is unique among the earth because he's made without fear. And he describes the Leviathan as being one who sees all things and is a king over children of pride. Now, those are really unusual descriptions to apply to just an animal. And these final verses really make me think this language is referring to Satan himself. I mean, our text started with Satan, right, arguing with God. in other parts of Scripture, in John 12, 31, and Ephesians 2 and 2, Satan is described as a prince of this world. So here we've described as a king over all the children of pride. He is described as having his own children of Satan, referring to the wicked, those who are not elect by God. The John 8, 38 and 44, 1 John 3 and 10. So you've got a prince, he has his own children. It says that those children are filled with pride, 1 John 2, 15 through 17. And then in Revelation 12, there is a creature that's described as a great red dragon, being clearly disclosed as being Satan. Now, we don't know if this is what Satan actually looks like, or if this is language that describes his attributes or whatever. But these are images that are used throughout the Bible, here in Job and also in other places, which is what makes me think that the Leviathan is as actually a form of referring to Satan. But so even if you hold that and go back and read, are you able to capture Satan or tame him or cut him up or stand before him? And the answer and all that is, again, no, it's something that God has made that's stronger than man, right? And we don't, as men, have the strength or the power or the knowledge to stand before God and call him to account. All right, and then we get into our last chapter. Job, he's going to speak for the last time in the text. He acknowledges that God is sovereign. Sovereign means you have the ultimate power and authority. He can do anything that he chooses, and that God has complete and perfect knowledge. Now, he repeats God's question of, who was darkening counsel by speaking without knowledge? And then he admits, it was me. I was the one doing that. And he acknowledges, I've spoken about things that I truly didn't understand, and I admit they are too wonderful for me. They're above his pay grade, so to speak. And then Job prays or begs, really, for God to hear his requests and ask that God would instruct him. Now, the Hebrew word that's translated in the King James Version as demand in verse 4 literally means to inquire. I don't think, based on the humility described in the verses before and after verse 4, that it would be consistent to convey Job with a tone of, still defiantly demanding God give answers, as opposed to one who has already been humbled and is requesting enlightenment on areas that he's now recognizes that he's ignorant. He admits that he doesn't know it. So I think this is not a fist-shaking demand, but a, please, sir, I'd like more information. So Job admits that, before now, he's heard something of God before today. But now that he's seeing God, now, granted, God's speaking to him still out of the whirlwind. So we talked about the ability to put on majesty and glory and righteousness and all the things that Job couldn't do. God still got a lot of those veiled. But just the glimpses that Job's been able to see and hear of God's voice, he's saying that from what I've seen now, I must, really thoroughly reject myself, and his own self-righteousness. And he had just repent in dust and ashes, that there can be no arguing or claiming that God was unjust. Only I need to be humbled in face of him, to repent in dust and ashes. Then God shifts his attention to the three friends. The three friends, 1 through 3, who had been trying to, condemn Job. And he expresses his anger. Now, Elihu, the friend 4, when he first spoke, he was angry at the friends as well, because they'd condemned Job and they had not been able to give a good answer to Job's speeches. And God expresses it here, says they had not spoken of God correctly like Job just had. And I suspect that he's upset with them for the same reason that prompted Elihu to be angry, that they were not able to correctly answer Job. And that, as he's advocating his own self-righteousness and condemning Job, condemning God. And so God gives them some instructions. And he says, you need to take 7 bulls and 7 rams, and you need to bring them and give them to Job so he can sacrifice them on your behalf and pray for you, because I'll accept him. But I'm not going to accept you. I'm angry with you. And so the friends, they comply, they do that. And God accepts both Job, who's now been humbled, and the sacrifices that have been made for friends 1 through 3. And then in the last, you know, 7 or 8 verses, 10 through 17, Job winds up praying, you know, after he's prayed for his friends, that God does indeed end the afflictions of Job. So if you had to describe the section, this could be like the epilogue, you know, so if you've got a play where it kind of sums up of everything that happened after the main events, God ends the afflictions and begins restoring him. And it starts off by sending all of Job's family and friend and acquaintances. These are all the people who had abandoned him up until now. He'd had these terrible afflictions and they had just, you know, whoop, we're not dealing with you. We have nothing to say to you. So they all wind up coming back to him and comfort him and each bring him some money to help, you know, get him up off his feet. And eventually over time, God blesses Job with twice as many camels and donkeys and sheep and oxen as he had initially. And it's down to the number. They give you the original number and then they give you, you know, twice as much. And, you know, again, over the process of time, he's blessed with 10 more children. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters to begin with. He'll have 7 more sons and 3 more daughters. And the daughters are described as being, you know, extremely beautiful, and it gives their names. And then after his afflictions, Job lives another 140 years before dying old and full of days. So that's the book of Job.